Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joe Starrs joins us here for just a few minutes. No secret that there are many prominent Roman Catholic lawmakers who are also pro-choice. Of particular concern is that some of them, some of the most prominent ones, sit on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And of course, that's a committee that is much on the minds of Americans nowadays, given the nomination of John Roberts to the Supreme Court to fill that vacancy. We're going to be talking with Joe Starrs about those Roman Catholic pro-choice lawmakers. And then in about 10 minutes, your questions and comments, your reaction. We have not asked you. It's been a couple of weeks, better part of 2 weeks now, and we have not asked you yet for your reaction to the John Roberts nomination. I'll be looking for that in about 10 minutes during Open Lines Issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then we'll be talking to Paul Coughlin about Christian nice guys. Joe Starrs is director of American Life League. Joe, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Thank you, Todd. Well, thank you.
I understand there is a protest, actually, that is planned for to send a message to these Roman Catholic lawmakers who are pro-choice. Who are they?
Sure. We actually had the protest today on Capitol Hill, and we are protesting the four Catholics on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Biden from Delaware, Senator Leahy from Vermont, Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts, and Senator Durbin from Illinois. These are all senators who are Catholic and yet are pro-abortion. They like to call themselves pro-choice, but I prefer the latter. And the reason we're protesting, we protested them today, is because these are four individuals who are, what they're really trying to do is push a pro-abortion litmus test on the judicial nominees of President Bush. And so we were out there today to say, no, you don't, that we're going to be watching you, and that you better give this guy Roberts a fair shake and not use his faith against him.
Is it true that John Roberts, the nominee to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court, is himself also a Roman Catholic?
He is he's Catholic and, by all accounts, a devout Catholic. His wife was on the board of a Feminist for Life, and well, we don't know for certain how Roberts would rule. We do know that he does adhere strictly to the Constitution, that he interprets it narrowly, and so we're optimistic in that regard.
How does it strike you that it is these Catholic senators, in particular Kennedy, Leahy, Durbin, Biden, on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who have been the most outspoken in, at the very least, saying there might be trouble for John Roberts ahead because of his religious beliefs?
You know, it worries me, and as a Catholic myself, that frankly it angers me. The fact that these four individuals claim to be members of the Catholic Church, which they are, and yet advance a legal theory that thinks it's okay to get rid of little babies in the womb, I think it's outrageous. And even more so, the fact that they're not honest enough to say flat out, if this guy's pro-life, we're going to nix him. Because that's, in truth, what they're saying without having the real courage to say it.
So how do you expect things to go for John Roberts in the U.S. Senate?
Sure. I think he's going to have a rough time of it in the Judiciary Committee. I do think they're going to beat him up, for lack of a better word, to the degree that they can. But I'm sure he's going to make it through okay. But I don't know if your listeners remember, but during the confirmation process of William Pryor, he was questioned for his, quote, deeply held religious beliefs. The implication being, if you are a deeply religious person, then, well, your fitness for the court or for the judgeship is in question. And I just hope and pray they don't pull the same stunt with Roberts.
I know that you don't deal with the church end of this so much, but what should the Catholic Church in America be doing about prominent lawmakers, especially at a time like this, when their votes and their ideas and their inclinations mean so much for the future of this country, especially judicially? What should the Catholic Church be saying to them or doing with them?
Sure. I believe that the Catholic bishops of the United States have a responsibility to approach their brother, as the scripture says, and if their brother doesn't mend his ways, then to say that you cannot approach the table of the Lord, i.e. Holy Communion, until you publicly repent of your sins. There have been a few bishops who have done this. I think a lot more bishops need to do this, and we're actively lobbying and encouraging our bishops to do this.
Lest our listeners get a misimpression about Catholics serving in our legislature, name, if you will, kind of the short list of other pro-choice Roman Catholic lawmakers outside the Judiciary Committee on the Senate or the House that may be of known to our listeners, and answer the question: are they typical for Roman Catholic lawmakers?
Well, in the House and the Senate, there's about 150 Catholics. Of those 150, 72 of them are, quote, pro-choice or pro-abortion. Kennedy, of course, is the most notable one, but John Kerry, of course, people know John Kerry. Nancy Pelosi on the House side, the most powerful woman in the Democratic Party, is a pro-abortion Catholic. So there's a rogues gallery, if you will, out there.
But it's about 50-50 when it comes to Roman Catholic lawmakers on the issue of abortion?
Correct, in the House and Senate, yes.
And do you expect John Roberts to be confirmed?
You know, barring some surprise, I do expect him to be confirmed. But I really do think it's sort of like the new kid on the playground. There are going to be a lot of bullies who know they can't keep him on the playground, but they're going to make his first few, his time out, a little bit very uncomfortable.
What kind of questions ought to be off limits during Senate hearings on John Roberts?
How are you going to vote on a particular, how would you vote on a particular case? I think a judge's philosophy is fine to discuss it, but anything that would tip their hand one way or the other, I think, should be off limits. And that's kind of the whole funny thing about the process. A lot of these questions are put forth in such a way as let's say it in such a way, and hopefully he'll weaken at some point and tip his hand. In a lot of ways, it's a charade, really.
Do you expect those kind of questions to be asked? How would you vote if Roe came up for consideration? Things like that?
I don't think they're going to be that blatant. I think they're going to try to, finesse it, if you will. But, you never know. I think when it comes to so many of the Democrats in the Congress, the issue of abortion is there. That is their sacred cow, and if there's any way that they can let people know that this guy's pro-life, by golly, they're gonna try to do it.
And finally, then, Joe, how do you respond to at least the initial reactions from organizations like NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and Planned Parenthood, very negative on John Roberts, just basically saying, in a word, unacceptable?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. It's a pretty knee-jerk reaction, actually. And they have the need to raise money, and so it's to their financial benefit, I suppose, to oppose anybody that Bush puts forward. Bush is a conservative. They should expect a conservative nominee. They shouldn't be surprised.
Here is the website for American Life League. Joe Starr serves as its director, www.all.org, www.all.org. Joe, thanks for being our guest.
My thanks. Appreciate it.
Your phone calls for the next 15 minutes, folks, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It has been the better part of a week since the president announced who would be nominated and go before the Senate for confirmation to fill the vacancy left by the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor. John Roberts is the man. I didn't hear, well, I don't have my ear to every piece of ground in the world, but I didn't hear anyone mention the name John Roberts before he was nominated, and then Suddenly, after he's nominated, everyone's wondering who he is. I want your reaction to the president's nomination of John Roberts, now that we've had about a week to digest it. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What do you make of the fact that without a lot of case record to go on the issue of abortion, he can, if he wishes to, simply not answer questions like, what do you think of Roe? And would you overturn it? And would you overturn a ban on partial birth abortion? He can choose not to answer those questions. And within the etiquette of the confirmation process, no one could fault him for it. I mean, except his enemies. Should he answer those questions? Do you want a litmus test? Well, tell us, yes or no, on Roe. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We begin with Richard, who listens on the Internet in New Jersey. Richard, welcome.
Hi, my question is, your guest said that John Roberts is a devout Catholic. How can a devout Catholic claim that Roe v. Wade is settled law? He's no Thomas More on this issue. Catholics have very clear teaching on the role of a secular state, and you cannot promote things that go against the moral natural law. So how can you say he's a devout Catholic if he says that Roe v. Wade is settled law?
That's an excellent question, Richard. Now, to be fair, Joe Starrs isn't still with us, but he didn't say he is a devout Catholic. He said, by all accounts, he's a devout Catholic. And I think he was speaking probably more there of his Catholic devotion than of his position. Now, John Roberts has said that Roe v. Wade is settled law. Well, you know what? It is. For now, it is settled law. Would I like to see it unsettled and overturned? Sure. Would John Roberts like to see it unsettled and overturned? Well, that's the question. You're absolutely right, Richard. If it were simply a matter of, I mean, as a matter of fact, it is settled law. Do I like it? No. But the question that should be asked of John Roberts to see whether or not he actually carries devout Roman Catholic bona fides on the issue of life is, do you like the fact that it's settled law? Would you like to see it reconsidered? Probably questions that won't be answered before he sits on the bench. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What about the rest of you? It's open lines for about the next 10 minutes here. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Richard's chimed in. Give me your thoughts on the Roberts nomination. We've had about a week to think it over and to look it over. I saw on the cover of a weekly news magazine just today, big picture of Roberts asking a question, in effect, you know, is this guy conservative? Is he really? Do we know? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's something we didn't get to yesterday, a very important Illinois story. According to the Associated Press, an Illinois pharmacist has told a congressional hearing that he will close shop rather than comply with Governor Rod Blagojevich's order, we talked about this last week, to provide the morning after pill. Pharmacist Luke Vanderbleek, we mentioned his name before, testified that as a Roman Catholic, he can neither provide nor help a customer obtain a pill that he believes destroys human life. But an advisor to the governor, that is the Illinois governor, said that the order only applies to pharmacies that sell other contraceptives. Well, let's hear from the congressman who hosted the hearing in question. Here's Congressman Don Manzullo.
He's a very devout Roman Catholic. But the issue is not whether he's correct in his belief. The issue is whether or not he should be protected in not dispensing this based upon his belief.
Now, here's the question. Rod Blagojevich, people have questioned how he got to this executive order saying that they had to do this. Let's lay that aside for a moment. Let's say it was a valid executive order. Well, if this is the case, can this pharmacist act within the bounds of his conscience and refuse to fill those prescriptions? He believes he must. Congressman Manzullo of Illinois says that that this pharmacist, Luke Vanderbleek, well, we have it here, that as a Roman Catholic, he doesn't believe he can do it, nor can he help people obtain the pill because he believes that the morning after pill destroys human life.
The pharmacist believes it's wrong, to dispense the morning after pill, and it's just as wrong to refer the person to another pharmacist that will do the very same act.
So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, here's a pill that you must, if a doctor's prescription comes into your pharmacy, that you must fill. If I'm Vander Bleek, I say, no, I can't fill it. You want to know why? I don't have the pill with me. It's not back here. I don't have it. I think that's a simple solution. Unfortunately, that's not a solution that the governors in Illinois is happy with. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Congressman Manzullo of Illinois says that pharmacies shouldn't be forced to violate their personal, and pharmacists shouldn't be forced to violate their personal beliefs.
The state cannot force a physician to write a prescription for the morning after pill based upon a conscience clause, and yet the state says the conscience clause does not apply to a pharmacist.
It has to. It has to. It has to apply to everyone involved in the system. See, that was the argument made by a guest here earlier when we were talking about this very case of Vander Bleek. It's not just the doctor. See, a doctor can refuse to do a thing or prescribe a thing on terms of his conscience. But the doctor's conscience, let me put it this way, the doctor's actions don't end when the person leaves the doctor's office with this prescription scrawled out on a little piece of paper. The doctor's orders have to be carried out by someone else. This is, to me, this seems very simple. If a doctor says, I want to perform an abortion, and therefore someone who works for me, who carries out my orders, has to help me do it. No, the nurse says, I will refuse. I won't do this. I think that the pharmacist is in exactly the same case, just an extension of the doctor's care, in exactly the same case as a nurse here. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. That's what's happening in Illinois. I'd like your reaction to the John Roberts nomination to the pharmacist there, Vander Bleek, who's being asked to do something that is against his conscience. He's willing to go out of business rather than do what the governor is requiring pharmacists in Illinois to do, and that is to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill. He is to be commended. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In a little more than 10 minutes, we're going to start a conversation with Paul Coughlin about Christian nice guy syndrome. He's written a book about it recently. We talked to Faith McDonald of the Institute on Religion and Democracy about religious persecution in North Korea recently on the program. Do you remember this? Well, she's not alone on the issue of calling to everyone's attention what's going on in North Korea with regard to religious liberty. Carl Moeller of Open Doors USA says that Christian leaders will not remain silent about North Korean persecution of Christians.
The State Department, including Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, knows our position on this and knows the religious community's position on North Korea. We're just not content with an economic liberalization in exchange for their nuclear program being reduced. We want the religious freedom issues brought up to the table as well.
Now, that adds to the agenda of the State Department something that they probably don't want complicating this whole issue. We're concerned about the nukes in North Korea. But what about, what did she tell us about it? You remember when Faith McDonald was on? She told us about witnessing an execution of two Christian people who had fled North Korea, been caught by the Chinese, and extradited back to North Korea. She said they no more got across the border. Then the graves were already dug, and the gun was put to their head, and they were killed. She watched, at a State Department briefing, a video of those executions. When I asked about the number of Christians there in North Korea who lived on the wrong side of the state, there's actually a state religion in North Korea that has as its divinity Kim Jong-il. What a god to have. A little guy who dresses, has hair like Elvis and dresses in jumpsuits. Very interesting and tragic god to have. Besides all of the other human rights violations that take place in North Korea, religious freedom ought to be on the State Department's docket. Now, Mueller says that the U.S. talks with North Korea on nuclear weapons should also focus on North Korea's persecution of those Christians.
The people of North Korea are suffering worse than a nuclear holocaust in terms of religious freedom. We can't talk about reducing nuclear weapons with this regime or giving them any sort of help until they deal with the issue of religious freedom in their country.
Maybe that's because at the root of this country's problem, North Korea's problem, is human rights and religious freedom. Okay, let's say for the sake of argument that we could somehow talk the North Koreans out of their nukes. Oh, okay, we'll stop. And what we've done, here it is. We won't do any more of that nasty nuke stuff. We would still have a huge problem. Essentially, an entire state that functions as a gulag. Carl Moeller of Open Doors USA says that North Korea is one of the world's worst violators when it comes to religious rights.
Tens of thousands of Christians are currently held in prison camps there in North Korea. These are forced labor camps where up to 18 hours a day, they're forced to work on basically starvation rations. These abuses are not just wild rumors. These are documented.
So, while we're talking about the nukes and no one wants Kim Jong-il with his finger on any buttons whatsoever except the remote of his television, but while we're talking about that, we ought to be discussing also the deeper, more pervasive and longer lasting problem in North Korea, and that is religious freedom, finally. Carl Moeller, president of Open Doors USA, says that these Christians are being starved and tortured to death in North Korean prisons.
This is an issue that we believe that the U.S. government needs to take up and not treat the nuclear issue in isolation from the religious freedom issues. These are all part of our discussions with North Korea. They must be.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When it's the Sudan and we hear about Christians in the south being persecuted by Muslims in the north, then we're deeply concerned, right? And the issue of weapons doesn't come in. We say this is enough to draw our concern. Even when it's the Sudan and it's Muslims in the West being persecuted by Muslims in the East, we're concerned about it. Before we go to this break, there is an organization, Underwriting Issues, etc., that is concerned about the religious freedom and the day-to-day needs of those everywhere in the world, including the Sudan and North Korea. LCMS World Relief. For more information about their Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts across the globe, give them a call here in St. Louis. Area code 314-996-1683. 314-996-1683. All the more important as we learn what's really going on in North Korea for us to support organizations like LCMS World Relief. Or look for their logo at our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Look for the logo of LCMS World Relief. Coming up, an hour-long conversation with Paul Coughlin. His new book is called No More Christian Nice Guy. When being nice instead of good hurts men, women, and children. We'll discuss the Christian Nice Guy Syndrome. He says he used to be a Christian nice guy, but no more. He used to believe in a Jesus that amounted to little more than just the bearded woman, but no more. And then in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc., Pastor Scott Stiegemeyer of Concordia Lutheran Church in Pittsburgh, who blogs himself, and Sandra Ostapowicz, who is a chair of the Web Committee for Higher Things, will join us to explain to us what blogs and blogging are really all about. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Why does so much preaching nowadays concentrate on the Christian rather than the Christ? Why is the Bible preached as though it were a self-help, self-improvement manual? Is the preaching of our sin and God's grace in Jesus Christ a thing of the past? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July is called Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today by Issues, Etc. regular guest Pastor John Pless. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book on the homepage or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for July, Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today by Pastor John Pless.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The recent disclosure that a popular video game includes graphic sex scenes, albeit hidden unless unlocked, has created concern about other games. Like anything involving computers, it's not an easy minefield for parents to negotiate. Terry Phillips attempts to provide a map of the problem.
For the record, the game with hidden pornography is the computer version of Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. But it takes a special modification program written by a modder or hacker to unleash the filth. Wes Nehi is editor of GamePro.org, a magazine and website for video gamers.
Maybe this means that the process of making games, you know, gets a little bit more scrutiny as well.
According to Patricia Vance of the Entertainment Software Rating Board, the computer-internet combo, as usual, creates the problem.
It's important for parents to know that, particularly with PC games, there is a large community of modders who make modifications available on the internet.
Meaning a change in the game can be downloaded as easily as updating any software program. The good news is the modifications have been mostly benign.
Usually, fans would go in and either add new levels to the game or add different costumes to their favorite characters in the games and things of that nature.
Non-computer versions for the consoles connected to the TV are fairly safe, and ESRB ratings on the package help, as do suggestions on the ESRB website.
We always recommend that parents play games with their kids, because then they can get a better understanding of what their kids are playing.
And it'll let your kids teach you some humility in the realm of child-parent competition. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
The video game rating system includes 7 symbols like E for everyone, T for teen, and M for mature. And there are 32 content descriptors that clearly convey what the kids will see as they play the game. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers, for an Ask the Expert on Thursday's Midday Living Jubilee. Chip Tynan, horticulturist from the Missouri Botanical Garden, will be our guest for the entire hour to take your questions and comments. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
You know, it's possible to read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July on our website, issuesetc.org. It's titled Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today. More information is available from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Handling the Word of Truth by Pastor John Pless, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July.
Well, I've been waiting for this book to come out and was very happy to read it recently. Paul Coughlin's new book called No More Christian Nice Guy, When Being Nice Instead of Good Hurts Men, Women, and Children. I'd written an article recently in the Issues Etc. Journal called Church is for Girls, and I would love to have had Paul's book at hand when I was working on that. And I've noticed on the shelves that there are a number of books that are addressing the same kind of issue. Whatever happened to men in church, and whatever happened to men among Christians? Paul joins us to talk about Christian Nice Guy Syndrome. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. For the next hour, we'll be talking about that with Paul Coughlin. He's host of a radio show in Southern Oregon and author of this book, No More Christian Nice Guy. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Glad to be with you.
Well, I didn't know that you used to be a Christian Nice Guy. You tell your story in the book, a sad and really truly tragic story of being a Christian nice guy. For me, what is most important is what you talk about, the kind of the Christian nice guy view of Jesus. What kind of Jesus did you believe in when you used to be a Christian nice guy?
Well, I always believed in a Jesus who was always gentle. He never got angry. He was endlessly patient. He went out of his way to avoid conflict, among other misconceptions. The fact is, the Gospels show a whole nother Jesus. This nice, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, is a work of fiction. It is right up there with the Da Vinci Code. But unfortunately, we have Well, it's almost our, it is our official view of Jesus. But when you look at the Gospels for what they are, you'll see that he was none of those things. He was far more rugged than we give him credit for.
In one of your chapters, you tell, to kind of drive home the point about who Jesus really is and isn't, you tell, I think you call it the parable of Jim.
Yeah.
Would you give us just a taste of that?
Well, in the parable of Jim, what I did is I strung together the more rugged words and actions of Jesus, and I created, again, this parable of Jim, and I took examples out of the Gospels. For example, Jesus said in the Gospel of Mark that it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out. And he had made this statement very clearly, and his disciples still didn't get it. Now, Jesus could have said a number of things to drive the point home more. Jesus chose to talk about excrement to drive his point home. Now, if an average Christian guy did that, he would be called a potty mouth, and he would be put into sensitivity training classes. I believe Jesus deliberately used frank, straightforward language to grab people in a way that, frankly, other kinds of language will not do. We have this view of Jesus as being a teetotaler, yet his first miracle is creating a whole lot of wine, probably where children were present. We have this view of Jesus as being always not wanting to ruffle feathers, yet this is the Jesus who said, "Blessed are those who do not find me offensive." Jesus knew what he was about, and what I did is I just collected these examples from the Bible. I did not make them up. And I put them essentially into the life of this fictitious person named Jim. And then at the end of the parable of Jim, I asked the reader just to draw some very straightforward conclusions. Do we think Jim is a Christian? Is Jim a nice guy? I argue that if we take Jesus' rough and tumble language and behavior and we change the name, we would argue in a kind of a knee-jerk fashion, that Jesus himself wasn't a Christian.
Would the real Jesus, the Jesus presented to us in Scripture, could he be a member in good standing in many evangelical churches, given what he says and does?
I would say no. I don't think he could be. He wouldn't last very long, because that the rugged side of the faith is not well represented in our churches, nor is it well liked. We'll take the sweet side. We'll take the don't stop the children to come to me side. And that is beautiful, and that is sweet, and that is a great example of love. It's just awesome, really. But we're not going to take the part where Jesus picked up a whip and threatened to hit people, and he kicked over tables. He wouldn't even allow baskets to be carried through the temple when he went on his he was really, really angry there, recorded in the Gospels. So, well, you know, no, he really wouldn't be. Let me put it this way. The entire Jesus would not be in good standing. A portion of Jesus would be, not the entire Jesus.
Is this nice guy Jesus that goes along with the whole nice guy syndrome in the church today, Christian nice guy syndrome, is he simply a truncated Jesus with some of his attributes left out, the edges knocked off, or is he even more open? Is he even more obsequious, saccharine, and groveling than even a truncated Jesus would be? Is this just a matter of not getting the right balance on him?
It is an issue of not getting the right balance. Right now, we of the behavioral spectrum that we see Jesus clearly commit in the Gospels, we really only hear sermons on the tender to a little tough side. Those are the ones that we will hear countless sermons. Again, we are encouraged, I have been encouraged for 25 years now, to be innocent as a dove, but not necessarily be wise as a serpent. Jesus never said one side was more important than the other, but the church sure does. We, for various reasons, we don't want the tough Jesus. And for many years of my life, I didn't want the tough Jesus either. I thought the tough Jesus would make my life worse and harder. What I didn't realize, it was making my life it's more demanding when you have the tough Jesus. This tough Jesus also has amazing power and wisdom that if you look at how he lived, how he really lived, and you emulate that, your life gets a whole lot better, and I speak from experience on that one.
I want to come back to kind of the transformation from Christian nice guy to good rather than nice in just a moment. One more question on the nice guy Jesus, and that
sure.
That is, could this account for why we hear less and less about Jesus in church nowadays? Because if you're really honest with what the text says of him, our sensibilities won't let us talk about some of this stuff.
Well, I agree. We're really influenced largely by this cultural norm that basically says if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. And I'm not only talking about how Jesus said that he is the only way to the Father. And I know that that is offensive to many people, yet this is what Jesus said. Certainly that part of things is offensive. But Jesus' demeanor, I would contend, at least aspects of his demeanor, we would find offensive as well. I mean, I think we find it so offensive, we really don't even want to look at it. We certainly don't talk about it, and we certainly don't devote sermons to the tough side of Jesus. And it's a real sad thing, because if we did, we would set a lot of people free, particularly men, because right now we're held up to this false ideal. I argue, in fact, I know that I think Christian men, to some degree, have it worse, because the non-Christian guy doesn't have this false, weak, naive, dour, robotic example that they're expected to follow. Frankly, the non-Christian guy kind of has a more manly man as an example. We really do have a manly man in Jesus, as recorded in the Gospels, but he's not the same Jesus as recorded in many of these Christian books and many Christian sermons.
Does the Christian nice guy syndrome also account for the attrition of men from the church to where now in the United States we're talking on a typical Sunday morning 60-40 in favor of women in the pews? In Canada, I heard from a theologian up there recently, the proportion is even broader there in favor of women.
Sadly, yes. Let me tell you a little story. I'm at a Christian writers conference, and there's many, many more women there than men. So it's very easy for me to talk about this topic, because what's interesting, Todd, is that women get this topic instinctively. When I tell them what I do, help passive Christian men to become more assertive, they kind of look at me like I'm a miracle worker, because they either have a husband or a son or a grandson who is really caught up in this lifestyle. One of the women who works for a major, major Christian publisher here in the U.S., she's an acquisitions editor. I told them about this, and she's a single Christian woman. And she said, well, Paul, me and my single Christian girlfriends have a saying now that the ideal man to date has only been in the church for 2 years. That way he still has some of his masculinity left. Christian men, and I think men in general, know that when they attend an average service, church service, that there is going to be a part of the masculinity that is going to be assaulted. It's going to be seen as bad and ugly and sinful. And that's a shame. And I think to some degree, this isn't the only reason why men avoid church, but I do believe it's one of them.
Or why they may last a year and a half and then realize what's happening and say, enough of this.
It's kind of like a death by a thousand stabbings, exactly. There are times, frankly, and I've been in church for 25 years, and I will continue to go, but there are times, well, I'll just keep track sometimes, and I'll lean over to my wife, and I'll say, listen to how many times we are encouraged not to do something, and how many times we're encouraged to actually do something. The average Christian walk is a list of what you don't do. It is not necessarily about what you do, and that works pretty well with the passive crowd. Passivity is all about what you don't do. It's not about what you do.
Now, I want to make this point. I don't know if you agree with me or not. We'll just find out here. And that is, I've written about this recently, and I had to be very careful to say that I don't believe that this is a feminization of men. I'm not talking about feminists, but I'm talking about, I don't believe that men are being made more like women.
Okay.
I just think that men are being made, they're being demasculinized. They're not being, they can't be made more like women. They are simply being forced to act less like men, and they don't end up being like women. They end up being nothing.
That's innocuous.
Yes.
They end up being innocuous. That's a good point. You know, I like what you're saying there because, frankly, many of the things that I write about in my upcoming book apply to passive women as well. There are some things in this book that really will grab more male sensibilities than female sensibilities. But we are all called to be followers of Jesus. We are all called to take on his likeness. And you make a good point when you say that we're being squeezed into a model that isn't necessarily feminine. It is just like nonness. It's just weakness in general. We certainly should not equate weakness with the feminine, and that's a good point.
You say the bland leading the bland is what you call it.
It is the bland leading the bland. I got to tell you that a really robust male, and for that matter, a very direct, robust female, they're just not going to find a whole lot of footing in your average church. I think they could find it in some. I'm sure there's exceptions to it, but that person's more likely to find fellowship in kind of a non-traditional fashion, largely to surround himself or herself with, you know, what you call a band of brothers, a band of sisters. And it's more likely that's the type of fellowship they're going to experience that they're going to find ignites their soul. Because, again, many of we're really encouraged to take on almost like a non-personality in church. And I'm trying to be kind and I'm trying to point fingers, but what I'm saying is likely resonating with many of your listeners.
Paul Coughlin is our guest. He's host of a radio program in Southern Oregon and author of the new book, No More Christian Nice Guy, When Being Nice Instead of Good Hurts Men, Women, and Children. Our call-in number, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So, Paul, what's the difference between being nice and being good?
Well, again, niceness, what I consider to be niceness is often disguised passivity. And that passivity is the result of fear. So many nice people, though not all nice people, have in the driver's seat of their life fear. And when fear is in the driver's seat, you can pretty much forget about the abundant life Jesus said he came to bring us, but also warned is hard to find. And so niceness is often a place of hiding. A nice person, when you think about the really nice people in your life, ask yourself, what do they ever really do? Do they ever, for example, stand up to injustice? Nice people don't have it in them to stand up to injustice. They don't have the backbone for it. They fear conflict so much that they will not enter into fighting for the right of another person, you know, the way Paul did with the runaway slave. Paul definitely was not a nice guy. He argued very cleverly, very crafty letter he writes to try to get the runaway slave to be treated well when he returns to his owner, and to Philemon, I believe. And it's a crafty, crafty letter. He's really going out of his way. He's sticking his neck out on behalf of another person. That is what a good guy does. A nice guy, it's not in him. You know, sure, he may smile a lot, and he may offer a nice little prayer for someone if they're in trouble and pat him on the back and give him that good, nice guy smile, but he's not going to extend himself for that person. It really is not an act of love. You know, standing with our hands in our pockets, jiggling change is not an act of love, but that is a nice guy posture. A good guy, which would also include gentleness and kindness, they extend themselves. They donate a part of themselves, whether it be their money or their energy, their emotions, their empathy, their sympathy for another person. Nice people don't really do that. They give the impression that they're doing that, but they're really just hiding behind a smile, and sadly, I did it for years.
At the same time, you say that with this passivity, with this fear that pervades the nice guy syndrome, comes manipulation.
It sure does, because I mean, the fact is, nice people are among the most deceitful people you'll ever meet. But it's also very hard to spot, and that is not by accident. It's very easy to spot the sins of an aggressive person. Often they're angry, often they're bullies, they push people around. And it's very easy to spot that. A passive person, first of all, you ask a passive person what they really think about something, they're likely not to tell you. They'll just give you a nice little smile and say, oh, everything's great. And you can tell by their life everything's not great, but they just have no desire to go really into the uncomfortable side of life. So, in addition, they have legitimate wants and needs. I write about an example in my life, what I used to call the sex wars in my life, because I just felt uncomfortable being direct with my wants and needs. I would try to find a way to get them met, but without making it look like I was getting them met. And so with my wife, I would do what's called a covert contract. I would come home from work, pat her on the back, rub her shoulders in the evening, and that was my way of saying, hey, I'm going to show you some affection later on when the kids are asleep, baby. You show me some. This is a nice guy trademark, and that was my way of saying this is what I want, but I never actually came out and told her. And so when my wife wouldn't reciprocate, I would either pout or get angry, and that's the wonderful passive-aggressive, horrible lifestyle that nice people live. And so, again, I had these legitimate wants and needs. I was uncomfortable being direct with them, and so I would go about it in a kind of a backhanded way, and it's just no way to live. What happens is your spouse, if you can hold on to one, the nice guys often end up being divorced. I was very fortunate that it didn't happen with me. They just put their spouse on eggshells. Their spouse doesn't know what to think. They kind of think they're going crazy, and it's a very, very horrible, horrible lifestyle.
Now, you talk about this, and I think what probably is the hurdle for most of our listeners is not that the syndrome exists, but that the syndrome is being, sometimes consciously or unconsciously, forged and encouraged and perpetuated in church, in what's being taught and preached and sung and everything else.
Yes, yeah, and that's why I argue that I think to some degree a Christian man has it worse. Basically, on any given Sunday, he is told to be like Jesus, but he is not shown the entire Jesus. This entire Jesus is a really amazing, awesome, powerful, redemptive force of good. He's a warrior of light. He is the most intriguing figure of all of history. You wouldn't really know that by many of the sermons that we've heard and that I've heard for you know, 20, 25 years. Because, again, we're only emphasizing the gentle side of Jesus. There is no conflict or contradiction when we say that when Jesus wanted children to come unto him and that he picked up a whip, that both are examples of love. His tenderness toward children, his anger toward perverted religion were both acts of love. They were both. He's defending the weak. He's defending the small, and but we don't see that right away. And I think it goes to a larger problem. I put this in the book: is we don't really appreciate paradox. You know, Christianity in America is a hard thing to explain because we're not really a philosophical people. We don't get it that love takes many different forms, and that it can look very different in different ways. And we have a Jesus who got it, and we have a Jesus who often didn't stop to explain it. He just did it by example. And then this is an audacious statement. When you look at the entire life of Jesus, he would go on to say that everything he did brings glory to God. Everything he did. This is a man who picked up a whip in a marketplace. This is a man who kicked over tables. It is an audacious statement to say that that brings glory to God. I believe it clearly does. In fact, it makes me worship him more. But to the modern American mind, including many within the church, that just doesn't wash.
We're talking about Christian Nice Guy Syndrome. Paul Coughlin is our guest. As we go into this break, let's talk with Kathy from St. Charles, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kathy, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say I have a 16-year-old son, 16 and a half, and he didn't participate in our Lutheran Church's youth group because of these very reasons that you're talking about. He just felt like it was for the wimpy guys, the passive guys, and the person who leads the group. Seems kind of feminized somewhat, always wears, you know, his hair just so-so, and, you know, it just... My son could not identify with him.
Yeah.
And the one particular kid was, you know, bothering him a lot to participate. And just, you know, my son was embarrassed because he is so very feminine and what he called nerdy. And so I confronted the boy and just told him that, you know, that my son doesn't want to participate. I appreciate his invitation, but the reason he doesn't want to participate is he doesn't feel like this is what he should do to become the young man that God would want him to be, because it demasculinizes him. Since then, the boy then left him alone. But I think it's a real big problem. And when you have boys, then they have to find other activities to do and other friends because they can't find it in church.
Kathy, thank you very much for the call. Paul, we're going to hold your answer to Kathy's comment there until the other side of the break. Paul Coughlin is our guest, host of a radio program in Southern Oregon, and author of the new book, No More Christian Nice Guy, When Being Nice Instead of Good Hurts Men, Women, and Children. There's a website you should visit. It's called ChristianNiceGuy.com. It's all one word, ChristianNiceGuy.com. When we come back, a response to Kathy's call, your phone calls as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is Jesus, you know what I've found, it's not just Jesus is nice, he's now become somewhat preening. He's a needy metrosexual. Some sermons sound like kind of a pitiful personal ad for Jesus, as though he's so desperately in need of our adoration and our affirmation, that's why we go to church. Well, he has more to give than we do. We have more that we need from him than he needs from us. This is a Jesus who is determined to find sinners where they're at, whatever the cost may be. He's a Jesus who is determined to die for them and rise for them and be a real redeemer. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Paul Coughlin on Christian Nice Guy Syndrome.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.